I had my cue card to make sure I did it correctly. It was highlighted for me, and I think I got it correct. I had to have a conversation, like, why do we need this? And I was shocked to find out that people had to be told what they had to do.
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where people, when they're introduced to the court, no longer stand up. It's amazing to me. I can't get over it.
Well, I was thinking on the way down here, why every single time do I come here, and it's not that often, am I nervous, whereas I can go into a court on a capital case and not be nervous? And I decided it was because every time I walked out of here, I felt what a lousy job I did. And I noticed by the lack of debate that I'm not alone in that assessment, probably. So I decided that probably what causes me to do that is I missed my senior year of law school and never had the course, and I tried to figure out what you're supposed to be doing instead of just being myself. So today I'm going to be myself so that I can feel that I'm not as nervous. In this particular matter, it is obviously a twofold analysis, and that first analysis is whether or not, looking at the affidavit within the four corners, there is sufficient information to provide probable cause, and I think even the state will concur that it is woefully inadequate. What we know about the reliability of the informant is that he is past proven, whatever that may mean, and we know that he has personal knowledge. And I happened to look at Gates today for whatever reason, and I found a particular sentence that is meaningful. Affiants have, and this is referring to another affidavit that was found insufficient, affiants have received reliable information from a credible person. And that's about what we have here, past proven reliable. And what does personal knowledge mean? I know in a jury trial what it means, because nobody knows what it means. They say, from your own personal knowledge, and people start rattling off hearsay. So I suggest that on just with that limited information, we're already into an area of we need corroboration.
Well, let me ask you a question about that phrase. Has past proven reliable become a proxy for we have gotten information from this person in the past? It's been the catalyst for an investigation. The investigation has resulted in arrest and convictions. That's what makes them reliable.
That is what you would like to hear. I mean, that's what you would like to assume as you read that.
But my question is, has it become to a magistrate who's independent and objective in reviewing this sort of a proxy for all of that, like a term of art, like res ipsa loquitur means the thing speaks for itself in tort law?
I cannot answer what it means to magistrates. I can answer what happens in the field, and different police officers have different thoughts about what personal knowledge is and what past proven reliable. They may have given information. Let's at least assume that they've said some things which have been verified. How inside information they are is open to debate, and that's where we get into this murky area. What does that mean? And it's, for example, it's on a report when they go into their intelligence file that they were involved in another investigation. And somebody will get a one blurb, he gave information, and later so-and-so was arrested. And they connect the two dots and think, well, it's because of this guy's reliability, as opposed to knowing that there's a lot of other things or other things independent of that. So I don't think it is a word of, well, it's not a word of science, but I don't think it is something like res ipsa loquitur, where everybody can say, we know what that means. The dog whistle means previous information, given that was reliable, of criminal activity, and either led to arrest or would have been sufficient.
Right, so you're saying that although the use of those words, may be intended to suggest that that meaning is embedded in those in that slogan, that's certainly not anything that's universally established, and therefore, the facts that give content to that slogan have to be set forth in the affidavit.
Right.
My question to you is this, and it's the same question I'm going to ask in connection with the dog issue. Is it your position that the need to have the specific information in the affidavit is the law, or is the argument that it should be the law?
The specific information with regard to the dog reliability or with regard to this information?
No, let's put the dog. I was just signaling that I'll ask the same question when you get to the dog issue.
Okay.
Let's focus on the reliability issue.
Okay. My position is that it is not the law. Illinois versus Gates clearly says that was Spinelli Aguilar, but now if you don't have that, then you have to have corroboration. And if that corroboration is sufficient in conjunction with that original information, you got a bonus. If, however, that in and of itself within that four corners, without ever lifting a finger to go out and do investigation, it says on its own there's enough there with face value to say this is reliable and it's probable, you don't have to. So it is not the sine qua non of a successful probable cause accumulation. It can be supplemented by independent police corroboration. Can be.
So there's no bright line rule. And if, as here, the specifics that would go to the reliability of the confidential informant aren't stated in the affidavit, you can cure that by having the police corroborate Absolutely. What they were told. And your argument is that wasn't done here.
That's correct. No. Take it to its furthest extremes. An anonymous caller can call up and say, Jack next door is doing drugs. Click. They know nothing. Now they go out there, they develop their own independent information. They now have probable cause. In this particular case, at the end of the day, when the police went out to the scene of the hotel, what was corroborated was that this informant knew a white male named Joe Accuri who had a New York connection. That's what they knew, sum and substance. What they suspected was there were drugs and drug dealing in New York and Delaware. They suspected he was in room 256. They suspected that the car sitting in the parking lot with the New York plates was his. They suspected there were drugs in the car. They suspected that he was accompanied by a white male, and they suspected there were drugs in the room. Now, going to the corroboration, we are allowed, you are allowed to take all reasonable inferences. And here is what I would point out. This is a police officer who, according to the affidavit, was involved in police work for 14 years with more than 300 arrests. What is the first thing he is going to do when he gets a name? NCIC computer. Does he have a record? We can assume, as a reasonable inference, that Cassidy, in this case, ran a Fury. We can assume, since you see nothing mentioned, there wasn't any criminal history. What is the second thing we would hope he would do? We would hope he would check DSP intelligence files. They keep databases on who's known people in the drug industry in Delaware. We can assume, after being in the Delaware State Police for 4 years and after 14 years, he would have touched upon that. We can hope, but not assume, that he would have reached out to New York State Police investigators to see is he a known figure up there. Again, we don't know that, and I'm not sure we can draw an inference that he's clean in New York. But we ought to be able to reasonably infer there's no criminal history and there's no indication of corroboration that he's dealing drugs in Delaware. We also could assume under different circumstances that the police checked with the hotel registry, because that's like 101. You're walking in a hotel with a dog. You're going to have the dog walking around. Wouldn't you go over to the clerk and say, excuse me, I'm Officer Cassidy. I'd like to see your registry, please. We can assume a reasonable police officer would do that, and we can hope that he would have done that, but he didn't put that in the affidavit. And if, in fact, it had been registered to a Curie, you would think that would have been in there. We can assume he would have talked to the, seen the number of occupants to see if there were two people rather than one. And we can hope that he would have talked to the clerk, to determine, did you check this person in and get some circumstances? So that means either one of two things happened. Even though he's right in the hotel, he's wandering around looking for rooms, and I would assume they would ask, where's room 256, kind of common sense, that he doesn't think, hey, could I check the registry, please, to see who's in there? Or we can infer he probably did that, and since there's no mention, it wasn't anything that was helpful. Now, I say that is an inference that could be drawn, except now in Delaware we have what I call the magic nose. And the magic nose means that everybody in police work, and particularly safe streets, knows as long as you got a smell, you got a good search. And it's just amazing over the past year how many magic noses there are out there. And we don't know how many magic noses get into people's cars and we never hear about it, but everybody in police work knows. I thought the smallest things that resembled marijuana to me. Has it been there for 6 months? Who knows? Who cares? Good search. So I'm not sure in this particular case, with the magic nose philosophy there, I got my dog coming in here, I got my information prime informant, don't need to do any more work. Then we get into drugs in the room. The affidavit says that the dog, quote, walked, or was taken, I won't get the quote, let's just say walked, quote, past entrance door, and past exterior of vehicle. Fine. The dog was positive. Fine. Where were the drugs? Doesn't say. Was it on the carpet? Was it on the wallpaper? Or was it coming from the room? When he's out there next to that car, is it coming from that car? Is he jumping on that car? Is he alerting to that car? Is he alerting on the ground? It is not shocking to think that people in motels might smoke a little bit of weed. And yet there's no indication, and the magistrate was left with the conclusion, or supposed to take the conclusion, if he walked the dog past the room, therefore, it must have been coming from the room, and that gives corroboration. And I don't think logically one can make that assumption without there being something more to tie it to the room itself. With regard to the court's decision below, I have to demonstrate that there was an abuse of discretion with the court's action. And I start out with something I looked at today for the first time ever. And actually, I have an admonition for you all from my colleague. This court's duty, while giving great deference to the factual inferences drawn by the issuing court, is to ensure that the magistrate had a substantial basis for concluding that probable cause existed. I read a case today and I thought, wait a minute. A Superior Court judge has to give great deference to a non-lawyer. And I remember 20 years back in the municipal court, the people that issued search warrants weren't even legally trained. They were court commissioners. All right, you're hired. You're the court commissioner. You have to give great deference to what some rookie magistrate's never seen the inside of a law school says? I don't think so. And I'm telling you this, just I made this observation. It all goes back to the Jensen case, which relied upon Spinelli and Ventresca, where there were federal magistrates who were legally trained who were making these determinations. That got put over into Delaware jurisprudence with that great deference when we had back, as you, none of you are as old as me, of course, Justice Steele gets close, Chief Justice Steele, excuse me, we had magistrates that got appointed for different reasons. Some were more capable than others, but to say that a Supreme Court justice has to give, as a matter of law, great deference to what some unknown, perhaps untrained legal person who sat and watched a magistrate figure these things out for a month or so, has to give a great deference, I suggest, is really not a real good standard.
Well, don't we give deference to the inferences juries draw from facts? What's the difference between the so-called 12-headed monster and a magistrate who doesn't have a law degree?
I've never seen in black and white you have to give great deference. It's the juries, well, I've never seen that particular. Deference, yes, whatever weight it deserves.
Yeah, I'm not sure the word great adds anything to deference, but if we defer to the fact finder, we seldom truncate the nature of the fact finder.
Okay, but there's a difference. The difference is the jury is the end arbiter of that decision of fact. In this case, the magistrate is the preliminary arbitrator subject to management. You're not management of the jury, they are management. So there is a distinction to be made about the weight that you would be giving them.
And I suppose the jury is making its determination based on its assessment of live testimony, whereas the lay magistrate is reading a piece of paper.
That is correct. And unfortunately, again, I have a defense point of view now, lay magistrates tend to be sometimes intimidated by the power of a badge and a uniform in terms of, okay, and that's just a matter of fact. In this particular case, the trial judge realized the issue with regard to the reliability of the canine. And essentially what she said is, it was a police canine with a dog handler who referred to the canine as a partner and called him a drug detection dog. So she took a label, and she took a position, and she says, ergo, reliability. And the three examples that come to mind which show that this is totally capricious and an abuse of discretion are three things that you're all familiar with. One is the portable breath test. If a police officer were to say to a suppression judge, I gave this person this thing to blow on, and I told them that it measures alcohol level, and I'm a police officer, yeah. What's the reliability? In fact, you all have said, I guess that's proper. This court has indicated in State versus Paula Miller, you have to have a properly calibrated portable breath test for probable cause. And I mean, that really sends out the message here. You can't be using things that are unreliable to reach determinations of probable cause. In drug cases, a I can't get it right, Duqua something reagent drug kit. They do that portable kit, whatever they do with it, shake it up and it turns colors. A manufacturer says this certifies and it measures the presence of THC or an opiate or whatever it is. The police officer doesn't just say, this is a drug testing kit, Judge, and I'm a drug investigator. This proved positive for marijuana, because the judge is going to say, well, excuse me, I need a little bit more than that. You've given me a label, and you've given me your position. That doesn't cut it. And in violation of probation's hearing, typically now, and fortunately none of you have to deal with this stuff, typically now a large percentage of violations of probation is coming up with dirty urines, oxy perks, whatever it may be, Adderall. And they use a kit. And that kit is certified by a laboratory. But if a probation officer walked in and said, Your Honor, I gave him this urine testing kit to prove positive, and I'm a probation officer, nothing else I added, it isn't going to be considered.
Well, don't you have to consider for what purpose, Mr. Hurley? Is it to create reasonable suspicion? Is it to allow a formulation that there's probable cause? Or is it proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
Probable cause, not reasonable suspicion.
Well, in terms of evaluating how credible that representation is, that this is a drug detection dog, he's my partner.
Okay.
That's my question. We know that the portable breath test, this gives you some reason to further investigate, but mm-hmm. it's not evidence that someone's under the influence. Mm-hmm. So it does matter how it's being used or for what purpose the test is being administered.
It does.
Where do we go with your suggestion? Does it mean that there has to be some kind of clinical test produced to show that 99.9 times out of 100 this dog has tested positive when there was drugs, or 78% of the time he has, or 85% of the time he has, therefore he is or is not reliable because 75 is good enough but 69 is not?
No, it's funny you ask that, because I just happened to glance today to make sure there was no new law. The first case, I think, is a federal case from Alaska, and the dog had a spotty record, but he was certified. And they said the fact that he's spotty, and I assume they're not referring to his
urinary.
Pardon me?
We know what you mean.
Oh, okay. The fact that he is spotty does not detract from the fact it can be given whatever weight it wants to be given. I think the standard is like anything else, some certification. If they had gotten Vitali on the stand and said, is this dog certified? Yes. What's his training? Did he get a diploma? Yes. End of case. Go on to the next. He doesn't have to be an A student. He could be a D student if he gets by the certification, just like some lawyers come out last, I'm told.
But your argument is that the probable cause rests upon a sniffing that was done by a canine, by a trained dog. The testor has got to attach a CV for the dog.
Not exactly CD, just a certification. That's why those people are out there, to make sure that the dogs know what they're doing.
Well, it's a certification. You mean the piece of paper that...
The training. There's a pro. I think it's 120 hours, but don't... There's facility. All the dogs they have, I happen to know this, they all have to be certified.
Okay.
I know that because I deal with this.
A copy of the certificate or a CV. Right.
Or they don't need that. He's a police officer. They train with them. We went to Brigantine, New Jersey, to the police dog training thing. It's a 72-hour, 120-hour course, and at the end of that, you have to have an accuracy rate of such and such, and Kia did very well, and she's been doing it ever since. And then they periodically will test them.
All right, well, to ask you the same question I did before, is that the law, or are you arguing that it should be the law?
It is not the law per se anywhere. It's reasonableness, because you wouldn't let anybody else you wouldn't let somebody come in with what he called a portable breath test and said, hey, this is my portable breath test here, try it, it works. Oh, excuse me, I need a little bit more. And I'm saying you need an objective, some kind of objective. I'm not sure it has to be certification, but there has to be something more than, this is my drug detection dog named Kia and he's my partner. That doesn't come close.
You wanted to save 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Maria Knoll representing the State of Delaware. Your Honors, in reviewing the totality of the circumstances within the four corners of this search warrant affidavit in this case, the magistrate had a substantial basis for concluding that probable cause existed for the issuance of the warrant. This case presents the positive canine alert plus specific detailed information from a past proven informant that's reliable, coupled with the police, independent police corroboration, all of which supports the magistrate's finding in this case.
Can you describe for me the independent police corroboration and examine for us whether that corroboration has to be something that's not ordinarily available for anyone in the public to see?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, the corroboration of the past proven reliable informant's information was them pulling up the driver's license of Mr. Arcuri, getting the positive identification from the confidential informant, having him ID him from two separate photographs to make sure they had the right person, going to the DoubleTree at the address that was given, the specific address given by the informant, with the specific license plate number and the car in the parking lot and the hotel room, and then added, as part of the independent police corroboration, the calling in of the canine to do the drug sniff.
What is the significance of the fact that anyone driving on 202 could have seen that same van and would have seen the DoubleTree there?
While they may have seen that, Your Honor, they may not have known that he was going to be parking at the DoubleTree, that his name was Joseph Arcuri, that he was staying at the DoubleTree Hotel with another white male in room 256.
Well, you're placing significance on the fact that the vehicle was there and that the hotel room did in fact exist, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And that the CI knew this, as he indicated from personal knowledge, where he was going to be, at what, on what day, and what was going to be in his vehicle, as well as the hotel room.
And you suggest to us that that's independent corroboration?
That with the addition of the police dog, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, in this particular case, an issuing court is entitled to make all reasonable inferences when reviewing an affidavit of probable cause. Because Detective Cassidy averred that the CI was past proven reliable, and the state submits that past proven reliable means that Detective Cassidy knows that the CI has been used in the past and proven to give reliable information to the police in their investigations.
Is there a factual, does the record factually support that those words carry all that baggage?
Your Honor, I can only look to the four corners of the affidavit in this case and what is a reasonable inference of what past proven reliable means and how it's generally reviewed in the context and case law. Past proven reliable. He knows who it is. He actually met with that CI to discuss this particular case, and he has indicated to in the search warrant that this person was reliable, gives reliable information.
Well, if the test is what the independent objective magistrate can discern from the four corners of the affidavit, what is there in the affidavit to suggest to that magistrate that he should infer that past proven reliable means there has been information of this kind given in the past, it's generated an investigation, the investigation has culminated in either arrest and or convictions for crimes similar to the one about which this informant's giving information today? Is that just assumed? As I asked Mr. Hurley, is this term of art simply a proxy for all that, or should it be spelled out for the magistrate so he or she could be comfortable having an understanding of what it really meant in connection with this particular informant?
Your Honor, I believe when the police say that they have a past proven reliable informant, it is a reasonable assumption that that particular officer has had it's by definition past proven and reliable to the police.
Well, if part of the requirement to issue the search warrant is the location of the home and some indication that there's contraband inside, let's say.
Okay.
And the police say, we believe there are drugs at this location. Should the magistrate then infer from that because the police say that's true, that the drugs that they want to search for are in fact there?
Based upon information, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I think I lost
well,
you.
Wouldn't my point is probably not well articulated. Doesn't the magistrate need more than a conclusory statement in order to accept it as a substantive evidence that would give rise to probable cause?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, and as we all know, there's different kinds of informants. This is not an anonymous informant, as was clearly stated in the warrant. This is not just an informant that is known but has not provided information in the past. This is what was called a past proven reliable informant. And as Illinois versus Gates has said, is once you have a past proven reliable informant, the other corroborating information may be less may be needed than in the case of an anonymous informant.
Yeah, well, let's not skip to point two.
Okay.
Let's stay with point one, which is, how does the objective independent magistrate make a determination that past proven reliable means X, Y, or Z? Are they supposed to take on good faith simply that because the police officer uses the magic incantation, proven and reliable, that establishes it as a matter of fact?
Well, Your Honor, I don't see where there's any suggestion that there was any reason to not take what Detective Cassidy said as true. It's just information that he provided, and whether the magistrate chose to believe it and give credence to it, in light of the totality of the circumstances with the other information, would we have perhaps liked to have seen more? Yes. Did we need more? I don't think so, not with all the other things that were done in this case, including...
Well, let's not talk about all the other things. We start with the information came from the informant. If it isn't proven and reliable, what's the point of corroboration? What's the point of step three? It all hinges on the catalyst for the warrant and the affidavit's information is the informant. The credibility of that information is the starting point for everything else. The question is simply in canning the magic liturgy, proven and reliable, is that enough for us to be comfortable that it's a reasoned analysis by the magistrate that caused this warrant to issue? Could he from that alone infer there was probable cause to believe that the corroboration was corroborating something of substance from someone of substance and so on?
The state submits yes, Your Honor. If it had been someone that he had not, that had not been past proven and reliable, he would have put that in the warrant as we see in warrants all the time. Anonymous, not past proven. We've had all sorts of warrants.
I'm obviously not articulating this well. What I'm getting at is, doesn't or don't the police have to put in the affidavit the why they believe the informant is past proven and reliable? Doesn't have to be anything more than they've given information in the past, which has caused us to investigate. The investigations resulted in either arrest and or convictions. So the magistrate can be comfortable that there's more substance to this than liturgy.
I don't believe they have to, no, Your Honor. And I don't believe there's any case law that suggests that they have to.
Well, tell us why, or tell me why, I could be comfortable with that. Just the assertion that someone's past proven and reliable without any independent facts to suggest to the JP that there's reason to believe that is a factual statement.
Well, Your Honor, I base that on the officer swearing on a warrant that this information is correct, that this person is past proven and reliable.
Well, let me try to get at the same concern in a slightly different way. What we are told by Mr. Hurley is, as the Chief Justice has pointed out, the words past proven reliable without any other supporting facts is a form of empty vessel. Now, and would not be enough standing alone. It might be enough if the affidavit said that we took the information that this informant gave us and we cross-checked it. That is, we independently corroborated everything we were told, you know, by going to the hotel registration desk, by checking the vehicle registration records, and we discovered that everything that we were told by this informant was true, that is, was verified. That isn't in the affidavit either. And that left only one other avenue of verification, and that is the dog sniffing out the drugs. And there again, the claim is that the dog may have sniffed something, but unless there is some evidence in the affidavit that this dog was trained to do, to sniff out drugs that are in a room that the dog is passing by, or is trained to detect drugs that are in a car that the dog is, you know, walking by, that the mere fact that the dog reacted to something isn't enough either. That's the argument that we're faced with. My question is there any element of that argument that's incorrect, or are all those arguments correct? And if they are, then what is the state's position?
Well, the state's position with respect to the confidential informant, as I've stated, is that the officer did attest that he was past proven reliable. He did not give prior information as to how this person became reliable, but he did submit to the court that that person was not an anonymous person, that that person was a known person to him, and has proven reliable.
Well, he used those words and did it under oath, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And you're saying that's enough.
Given the fact, it's, Your Honor, in the scale of between anonymous informant and known informant who has not provided information in the past and an informant that has provided information in the past, I do think that's enough for a past proven informant, yes.
Are you, let's move then to the corroboration.
The corroboration.
Or lack thereof.
Okay.
Do you agree that there was no corroboration of the room, of whether or not the defendant was in room 256, no corroboration of whether the car, the information about the car that was given to the police was independently corroborated through vehicle registration?
Not in the warrant, no, Your Honor.
Right.
What the police did corroborate was I submit that the car was there where the CI said the car was going to be, at the address that the CI said the car was going to be at, and then the drug dog, yes, Your Honor, and corroborating the identification of Mr. Arcuri, whose name he knew.
Is it correct that the trial judge in this case noted that the affidavit contained no representation or details about the informant's credibility?
The only, I guess, correct in the sense that there was no indication from in the affidavit how he was reliable, only that he was reliable and past proven.
Is that a problem?
Your Honor, when you take this case in the totality of the circumstances, I don't believe it's a problem, no. I believe it's a situation where we may have wanted to have more information, but we have sufficient information in this search warrant.
So your position would be that the later corroboration is sort of a gap filler for the lack of testimony about the, or a statement about the credibility of the informant?
Well, I believe it's a gap filler. I believe it's corroboration in the sense that he said there was going to be drugs in both this room and in this car, and the dog positively indicated to both the room and the car.
Okay, let me give you this quote from Gates and ask you to respond to it. An officer's statement that affiants have received reliable information from a credible person and believe that heroin is stored in a home is inadequate. Sufficient information must be presented to the magistrate to allow that official to determine probable cause. His action cannot be a mere ratification of the bare conclusions of others. What is a statement that this person has given proven reliable information in the past, anything other than a bare conclusion for the magistrate to examine?
While I don't disagree that that's not a bare conclusion for the magistrate to examine, in this particular case, there's more than just the tip, Your Honor. And in that particular quote, that was the only thing that Illinois Lease versus Gate was talking about, was the confidential informant.
Okay, well, if then we examine the corroboration, there's at least in some of our cases, Flannery comes to mind, there's a question about simple confirmation of readily observable facts does not enhance the reliability of a tip. Now, the readily observable facts here were the car and the existence of the Doubletree that had a room number consistent with the information they received. How do we deal with the quality of your corroboration before we get to the dog?
Well,
what else was there?
Okay. Well, one major difference between this case and the Flannery case was that Flannery was an anonymous tip.
I understand that.
Okay.
But that would mean that there's some distinction with the difference.
Well, Your Honor, in an anonymous tip, that particular person would not suffer any sort of ramifications if they gave some bad information. In this particular case, that would be a different scenario.
Okay.
In Flannery, I believe it was saying, I'm not sure, but it was that they observed someone, I believe, acting suspiciously and did not give anything other than that person is there right now. I thought it was something like that. In this particular case, he gave the defendant's name, the fact that he was staying with a friend, and what room he was going to be staying at, and also exactly that he was going to have drugs in both the car with the license plate and the registration, I think, number, and the drugs were going to be in the car and in the room. So it was a little bit more specific, my understanding is, than Flannery.
Before the dog, the only thing corroborated was the vehicle in the parking lot and the existence of a DoubleTree hotel with a room number consistent with the information.
And that they were both talking about Mr. Acor, yes.
That's it.
I believe so, Your Honor.
All right.
And turning to the dog, the argument that we're faced with is that there was no, I mean, other than the disclosure that this was a canine dog and it was my partner,
drug sniffing dog, I believe, yes.
Nothing that demonstrated the training, any training, let alone the quality of the training. What is your response to the argument that in these circumstances, at least, that information should have been provided?
Well, I have a couple responses, Your Honor. The first one is the case law at this point that I'm aware of doesn't require that these qualifications be given in the affidavit.
The other side agrees that there's no bright line rule.
Correct.
But is arguing that whereas here there was no specific information given to give content to the slogan past proven reliable, and whereas here there was no independent corroboration that the car and the hotel room were either the defendant was the owner of the car and the occupant of the room, then the information about the dog became critical, and there was no information.
Well, and that's the argument, Your Honor, but the state argues that under the totality of the circumstances, the two things together is enough for probable cause. As I had said before, would we have liked more information on each? Yes, we probably would have liked more information on each, but we have the two together, and the state submits that that's enough. With respect to the drug-sniffing dog, it is reasonable to assume that they got a dog that knows how to sniff drugs and
just
that they...
Because the dog was described as a canine and
a drug-sniffing dog. It would be reasonable to assume that a police officer is not going to go and get any dog, but he would want to get a dog that has the experience to sniff out drugs if that's what he wants to have done, to do its job.
Well, we're reexamining the same problem in a different factual scenario. How is this different than the Illinois versus Gates statement? Again, the magistrate's action cannot be a mere ratification of the bare conclusions of others. The representation that this is my dog partner who sniffs drugs, how is that more than a bare conclusion offered to the magistrate? There's nothing to support that this is a drug sniffing dog who has been trained and has the following track record, and there's reason you should rely upon it in determining probable cause. It's just a bald assertion. He's my partner.
Well, Your Honor, what I can say is under Illinois versus Gates, they used the totality of the circumstances, and they did say that sometimes some of the information might be bare bones, but you still have to take it all into consideration to decide whether that's enough. And that's what this is, a totality of the circumstances.
Well,
to decide.
Well, three things of ice in a glass doesn't make iced tea. So the question becomes, what is the substantiation for, first, the credibility, reliability of the informant beyond the bald assertion of the police, and then the reliability on the dog sniffing technique based on the bald assertion of the police officer?
Your Honor, the state submits that they corroborate each other, and that's what the extra information was about.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That last argument, in case the court didn't recognize this, what's called bootstrapping. They corroborate each other. There are 3 degrees of reliability that a magistrate could issue a search warrant on. The best is the way it used to be back when you were a Superior Court judge. He is a confidential, reliable informant who has given information on 6 different occasions leading to the arrest of 3 people and the conviction of whatever. That is the way that it was done. And then for some reason, it started to be chipped away and diluted, so then it comes into this thing. That would be the absolute best. You could then look for yourself and say, that magistrate had a good basis. Or two, Cassidy could say, I'm a cop for 14 years. I've had over 300 arrests. I say to you, this guy's reliable. And you could say, well, it's not as good as the first, but okay, I can go with that. You just made it. Or 3, and the state keeps trying to get there by saying he knew him personally. He didn't. He didn't. It's not in a warrant. Or 3, what we have here. He's past proven reliable. What does that mean? Nobody knows. Just take it at work for what it's worth.
Mr. Hurley, you're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.